Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. A mystery set in a rural village in the west of Ireland, The Hunter, is the second novel by bestselling author Tana French, set in mythical Ardnakelty. It's a blazing summer when two men arrive. One of them is coming home. Both of them are coming to get rich. One of them is coming to die. Cal Hooper took early retirement from the Chicago Police Department and moved to rural Ireland looking for peace. He's found it more or less. He's built a relationship with a local woman, Lena, and he's gradually turning Trey Reddy from a half-feral teenager into a good kid, going good places. But then Trey's long-absent father reappears, bringing along an English millionaire in a scheme to find gold in the townland. And suddenly, everything the three of them have been building is under threat. Tana French is the New York Times bestselling author of 8 previous books, including In the Woods, The Likeness, and The Searcher. Her latest is The Hunter, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Tana French to this week's book show. What a delight to have you back. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Joe. It is lovely to be back.
I love having you here, and it's a great pleasure to have you on the program, as always. I don't remember if I asked the question at the end of our last interview regarding The Searcher, but of whether you would continue with these fine folks. But did you know that at the end, that these were people you were going to hang on to for a little while?
No, if you asked me that at the end of our last conversation, I'm pretty sure I said, no, I'm done with them, because that was definitely the plan. But then I kept thinking about sort of the world I'd set up in The Searcher, this sort of odd mix of genres where it's basically, it's mystery software running on Western hardware. And I liked that. And I thought there were more Western tropes that would probably map really interestingly onto the West of Ireland. In The Searcher, I'd been playing with sort of, you know, the stranger who blows into town and everything changes around him. And I was thinking in The Hunter, well, what about the gold rush trope? You know, the whole there's gold and then there are hills thing that shows up in so many Westerns. Well, in Ireland, it sounds like an unlikely place for a gold rush. But actually, what Johnny says in the book is true. There have been huge numbers of ancient gold artifacts found all throughout Ireland. And there have been little mini gold rushes here over the centuries. Right up until recently, there are still people looking for gold in the mountains. So I thought, how would a gold rush do in the mountains just up beyond Ardnakelty? And I was also thinking about that trope of the adventurer who comes home and he's always bringing trouble with him. Trey had this absent father who seemed like the type who, if he came back, would come with some complicated con, a scam, something. So I thought, well, what if his complicated con involves a gold rush? And it all went from there.
I love the terminology of mystery software operating on Western hardware. That is a great way of putting it, because I had a friend, we were discussing this book over the weekend, and we said, I don't know, it seems unfair to call this a mystery because it's so much more than that, and it's so in-depth, and there's such beauty and such inclusion as to the feelings and the murkiness of our relationships. Well, you use the word trope, but it'd be beyond that idea of what a mystery is.
Well, I've always thought that mystery gets a bad rep for being quite shallow and two-dimensional, when actually it's the perfect genre in which to explore the real mysteries, which are the human mind, human relationships, how people get from one point to another within their own minds. You know, it's about murder. How does a normal person, not, you know, somebody who's the essence of all evil, how does a normal person get to the point where they are willing to take another life? What can take them there? What is going on in the network of relationships in a small town? These, to me, are fascinating mysteries. They're much more interesting than the mystery of, you know, who killed this person. And the mystery genre, which delves so well into psychology and motive and relationships, seems like kind of the ideal terrain for this.
Now, with that said, and having read many, many mysteries in my life and loving the genre, at the end of this, I was like, whoa, did not see that coming. Did not see that coming. And it just sneaks up on you. I mean, that's a thing of beauty. That doesn't happen very often. And especially for mystery readers, they're always looking for that angle. And this is really so beautifully done, but it's plausible for all the right reasons, because there's such emotion attached to it that it makes just perfect sense.
Oh, I hope so. Thank you so much. Because to me, the character is always more important than the plot. The plot comes out of the characters for me, which is one reason why I never have my plot plotted before I start writing. I have to figure out what the characters are going to do and why, you know, what their relationships are and what would come out of them. So for me, the fact that it's emotionally plausible and that the events come out of who the characters are and what they feel about each other, that's what it should be. That's what I'm aiming for. So it's really great to hear that work for you. Thank you.
So there's a little bit of solidifying here among the characters where you left us off on the searcher and where we pick up on the hunter, where the relationship has evolved between Cal and this half feral teenager that is Trey. And Lena is now become Cal's girlfriend and they're having a relationship. We sort of left in the last book and start off this book kind of what Cal was ultimately looking for when he fled Chicago.
In a weird way, I think more subconsciously, because on a conscious level, he felt that he had somehow betrayed his sense of what makes a good man and could no longer count himself as a good man and had made a mess up his marriage and his relationship with his daughter. And he was hoping just to get away from all the complications of that and find somewhere where things were simple. Now, of course, a small town may look like a place where things are simple, but it really, really is not. So what he found there was more complications. But by the time the hunter starts, they have built a kind of fragile balance. They're almost a pseudo family, but it's a makeshift family. In the books, there's a bit where Cal thinks of it as like the dry stone walls all around the West that are sort of put together haphazardly out of need, made from what's there. And yet they hold together. They withstand time and weather. And that's sort of what they've built, this odd makeshift thing. But it's still new. It's still fragile. It's solidified a bit, but not enough. And when it comes under threat from the pressure of Trey's dad arriving and wanting her for his own purposes, then it's still fragile enough and new enough to be a bit shaky. And all three of them have to decide, is this something that I want to solidify further? Is it worth making sacrifices for, or can it be sacrificed?
One of the things that you do, which I thought was just masterful, the detective comes into the picture from Dublin to figure out what happened. There is very much this small town versus the guy from the big city coming in, understanding what they mean, understanding the mechanics of the place. Cal, who's just started to figure all this out and what it is to be a local, is really interesting because you talk quite a bit about even the language of the sound of understanding where a person comes just from hearing their voice.
Yeah, he's in an odd position, Cal, in this book. A lot of the characters are in this sort of liminal zone where they're not quite insiders, not quite outsiders. And that's a very interesting place to be. Like Lena's there because she's deliberately distanced herself from the townland. Trey is there because she's from that family that every small town has, who they figure are really not worth the effort and should probably ideally moved somewhere else. And Cal, of course, is an American who only moved there a few years ago. And so when the detective arrives, he finds himself in this really odd place where he's an insider, but he's not. And he's a detective, but he's not. And the detective is trying to use him as a detective. And the locals want him to be a local. And he's forced to choose a position for himself. He's forced to figure out who he belongs with, whom he counts as allies, where his allegiances lie. And I think that's a very interesting position for a character to be in, is that half insider, half outsider mode. Because you have a certain amount of influence, but you're not bound by the rules. So he has to pick, is he a detective or is he a local?
And going back to Trey for a moment, as you said, being from that family, but also a teenager. So teenagers are always in that kind of limbo, right?
Teenagers live in that liminal zone. It's funny, somebody pointed out to me recently that an awful lot of victims, specifically in my books, have been teenagers. And I think it's because they operate in that limbo zone, which is quite a vulnerable place to be. You're in a turning point. You're moving from one solid place, which is childhood for many people, into another, but you're not there. So you're in flux. So it's much easier for you to be vulnerable. And Trey's definitely at a transition point in her life. Over the course of this book, she takes that leap from being a kid where you see everything in black and white. You want one thing and you want it wholeheartedly and you have no room for anything like nuance or shades of gray or opposite poles. But at the end of the book, she's had to recognize that is not the world that adults live in. It's not the world she's going into. There are shades of gray. there are sacrifices that need to be made. And her whole relationship with Cal and her relationship with the revenge she wants have shifted into something more mature and more nuanced, whether she likes it or not. But writing that moment of teenage transition was a lot of fun.
I bet it would be a lot of fun to write about. It also fascinated me because Cal's complaining that the child can be a brat. Lena's complaining that the child can be a brat. We see her being bratty, and yet we're pulling for her. You want this child to succeed, as do they. And you see that place of this is a teenager, but she's very much a very strong woman, a very strong character.
Good. I think kind of that was necessary because Trey's had a really tough upbringing. She's basically been bringing herself up until the searcher, because her dad is actually more useless when he's there than when he's not. Her mother does her best, but has very few mental or emotional resources. So Trey's just been winging it. And while she is bratty, it's actually, this is going to sound weird, but a good kind of teenage bratty.
Oh, sure.
Because it comes from strength and determination, which as a pseudo parent, which Cal and Lena are, you want those traits, but you want them channeled in ways that won't do damage to the kid. And that's what they're trying to do. They have a perspective. They see the risks. They see the dangers. When Trey kicks back and goes, no, I want to do this, they're trying to instill the adult perspective, which of course is completely impossible because teens can only get there in their own way. So it's the quintessential conflict that you get between teens and adults who really care about them, but occasionally just want to yell at them.
It is, but hers is not an irrational conclusion. She comes to this very much through great thought, a great experience, and an understanding. And while there may be some missteps, she has thought this through quite a bit.
Oh, yeah. She's thought it through, and she has excellent reasons for every choice she makes along the way. It's, I hope, anyway, because as a writer, it's your job to make sure that every character has good reasons within their own parameters for what they do. You never want a character to do something that's unjustifiable, because from the character's point of view, they're right. They're not being stupid. They're not being rash. They're not being evil. They're doing what makes sense. And in Trey's case, I hope that she's got perfectly logical reasons for wanting the various forms of revenge that she goes after. And when she decides to change her plan, she has good reasons for that. It's just that as she changes over the course of the book, her reasons, quite painfully at some points, have to change too, because that's what happens when you get that bit older and your perspective on the world shifts.
I did not think of this in my role as a reader, but in my role as an interviewer, I did think about this at one point, which was the fact that what it was like for you when you last wrote this character, she was 2 years younger. And in teen world, that's a hell of a 2 years.
Oh, yeah. That was one of the huge things I spent a lot of the time thinking about. Cal and Lena are in their 40s. The amount you change in 2 years in that amount of time, there can be extrinsic changes. If something huge happens, you'll change in response. There was a shift in most of us from COVID, for example. But a teenager is changing intrinsically. The changes come from within. And in order to write Trey a second time, I had to take that on board and go, how far has she come in those 2 years, both just from 13 to 15 being a huge shift, but also from having people who are responding to her needs for basically the first time in her life? What's that going to do to her? And I was figuring she's going to be less feral. She's going to be more talkative. She's going to come out of herself a bit more. She's going to be trying to do things that will make the relationships between her and Cal and Lena work, making an effort. But that, I think, is what her father, when he comes back, he sees all that because he's quite perceptive and he uses that. He tries to use it for his own purposes. And she has to keep up with that and figure out to what extent she's willing or not willing to be used for somebody else's ends.
Tana French is our guest. The new novel is The Hunter, and it is published by Viking. You write a lot in the book, especially regarding Cal, Trey, and even Lena, about, and this begins with Cal, but their code. And you use that word a lot, the code, and the code that they live by. And that's a fascinating thing because that's a sliding scale too.
Oh yeah, it's sliding and it comes from such different angles. That was one thing that I sort of picked up from the Western influences on this book, because morality is a big deal in Westerns, and in a way that, in the best Westerns anyway, I really like, because Westerns deal a lot with good and bad, but they tend to deal with it in a very matter-of-fact way, with an acceptance that sometimes good people do bad things, sometimes bad people do good things, sometimes there are situations where there is no good thing to do, and you've just got to find your way through them. And I think that at a moment where we all have a tendency to be quite judgmental and to snap to the idea that anyone who does one bad thing must be an evil person, you know, it's quite interesting to deal with this Western idea that good and evil are complex. They are woven into every day. There's not always going to be a good answer, but you need to have a code by which you live. You need to have your red lines. I will never do this. I will always do this, regardless of circumstances. So that was something that I felt needed to be built into these books, and in different ways, in that Cal, as an adult and as one who has thought about this, has his code very clear, which doesn't mean he always sticks to it, but it means that when he doesn't stick to it, he feels that and feels the need to try and rectify that. Whereas for Trey, this is an evolving thing. This is something that's only just starting to develop as a concept, and she's finding the elements of her code as she goes. She's finding the things that she will never do under any circumstances. And that discovery, those moments where she goes, okay, I've run up against a moral brick wall, those are the things that shape her and mature her and make her a more grown up, closer to adulthood at the end of the book than at the beginning.
And sometimes when there is that brick wall of a relationship with someone, it's because there's an assumption perhaps on Trey's part of what Cal's code is or what Lena's code is or how they're thinking something through.
Yeah. And when those intersect, it can get quite complex and interesting. There's a moment where Lena, I'm trying to do this without spoilers, but where Lena finds herself doing something that she has sworn to herself all her life that she would never do. She's having to shift that code in response to circumstances and go, wait, one of my highest priorities was to not in any way bend someone to this townland's will, but here something has come up that is a higher priority for me and for the people I love. And so I'm going to have to break this code, regardless of whether I'll feel guilty, whether I'll be able to live with myself. It still needs doing. And she has an awareness there that Cal would see that event from an entirely different perspective. And she has no idea whether for him, this will in some way be unforgivable. And the same for Trey. There are moments when she doesn't know whether what she's doing will fit in with one of the other characters' code in any way that they will find forgivable. And I think what all of them miss at different points in the book is that for the others, forgiving the people you care about is pretty high up in the code.
I love the word townland.
Yeah, it's a very Irish thing. It's a small collection maybe of farms and villages. So even if you're not within the village per se, you're still part of this townland. And it can have as few as, you know, a couple of hundred people. The relationships within that townland will go deep and will go way, way back, so that by the time you're born into this townland, your relationship with many of the other people in it has already got a shape on it from the generations who went before you. And that has upsides and it has downsides as well. It's a fascinating place to write about. Writing about a townland is very different from writing about a city neighborhood.
We talked about Cal, we talked about Lena, we talked about Trey. These are the characters who we are introduced to in the last book. We meet Neelan, who is the police officer. We of course, meet Johnny, who you mentioned, who is the deadbeat dad, for one of a better term. A character that I found fascinating in the last book and in this book as well is Mart. And Mart is Cal's neighbor. And I just noticed whenever Mart appears, you use the word stumping. Mart comes stumping across. And whenever Mart's arrival happens in the book, he's stumping. I'm curious as to the derivation of that, but also of what it is about that that becomes such a, I don't know that I know completely what that means, but boy, I have a visual picture when you say that of what Mart is like.
That idea of Mart changing the rhythm whenever he comes in, just changing the tone, and his pace and his walk and his everything just demand a shift. Because Mark is one of these guys who you get, in particular in a small townland, in a small community, who they don't seem to be very much when you first meet them, because they're playing for the comedy a little bit, they're playing the local character, they're playing things for laughs, and the sense of humor is real. But underneath that is a level of drive and power that can go unrecognized for a really long time until the stuff hits the fan and suddenly things get real. And all of a sudden, that power and that drive manifest and you're forced to deal with them. And Mark's like that. And one of the ways it shows itself is that when he comes in, the tone shifts to his, the rhythm shifts to his. And I think that's probably why, without noticing it, I'm using him stomping in with a certain amount of force and at his own pace.
Right. And that's recognized by Cal and most of the others of just how, okay, put up with a guy, it's fine, and then he'll be gone, and then we'll get back to what our life is. I love your incorporation of dogs in the book. I assume you're a dog person.
It's funny because not all that much. I like dogs a lot, but I've got to admit, deep down, I'm a cat person. But the thing is, I felt like dogs just fit into this book. They're just needed. Maybe it's the Western influence again. Everybody needs their animals around them, and they need to be working animals. They need to be not just animals of leisure who occasionally demand feeding, which, let's face it, that's what a cat is. It's there for, you know, love, right. Annoyance, and food. Whereas a dog is woven into your life in a whole different way. It's going side by side with you. And these dogs, you know, they're working dogs. They're farm dogs, sheep dogs mainly. Not so much cows, but, you know, these are companion animals. And I felt like anything that's a Western, even a West of Ireland Western, it needs those.
You mentioned Western, and I meant to bring this up earlier, but as far as setting the tone and the place, it almost had to be in summer, right? I mean, we are in just the hottest, the dog days, just the horrible days of summer where everything is dusty and dried up and we're worried about drought and things are pretty bad, which is very evocative of a Western as well.
Yeah, that was one of the reasons I went that way. I wanted something that would feel like there was unnatural pressure on this place, something that they couldn't get out from under and that was changing the shape of things. And now an Irish heatwave, just to make it clear, it is not like the ones you guys get over there. Like, we'd be talking once the temperature hits, what, low 80s in Fahrenheit for more than a few days, the papers start running articles about how to survive the heat wave, and everybody is taking time off work to sit in the park and turn the color of lobster. But the thing is, that's in the city. In the countryside, this is a very different thing because it does feel unnatural. Down the west in particular, soft rain is the norm. It's what you expect. But for these guys, it's not just a symbolic sense of pressure. It's very concrete. This kind of heat wave, it's threatening their crops. It's threatening the feed for the winter. It's threatening next spring's lamb crop. Everything is under threat. Their financial livelihood is under threat here. And that's what makes them a little bit more vulnerable when Johnny shows up with this amazing scheme to find gold and make them all rich. These are smart, sensible guys who most of the time would tell him to shove it and get lost. But at a moment when they're feeling their livelihoods threatened, they're a lot more vulnerable. So the heat wave, I needed it for atmosphere, but also for the plot.
And also, I mean, I don't know how much of your intention is, but I mean, it's impossible to read it and without thinking about climate change as well. I mean, this is something that, as you just said, is having an economic effect. The young people are having trouble finding jobs because everything is much warmer than it used to be.
Oh, yeah. And this is a very real thing. I think farmers are the ones who are noticing it more immediately in more concrete ways almost than those of us who live in a city and who can, you know, get a fan if it's hotter at night. For them, this is vital stuff. And it was very much in my head going, climate change, this heatwave summer is not a once-off. This is an ongoing threat to their entire world.
So there's a number of ways that I can ask this. So I will do it this way, which is when you leave the characters the way you have left them in this novel, is there an assumption on your part or a thought on your part that you will look at them once again to see where they wind up in either a few years or somewhere down the line?
Not somewhere down the line. Again, I left this book going, right, okay, they're sorted now. I shall move on and do something else. And then I went, I don't feel like the arc here is complete. Like, The Searcher is very much about a book about an outsider. And The Hunter is very much a book about, not about one guy anymore. It's about a relationship between three people, which is why there are three narrators there,
Right.
because the real heart of the book is in between those three people rather than in any one of them. But it's a book about three people who are in that liminal zone between outsider and insider. And I went, well, that's an arc that feels like it might need finishing off by a book about being an insider in this world. It just felt like the arc of the Ardnakelti world isn't complete. Like, this is a place that has so many stories and so many secrets, and that is just further developing its relationship with each of these people, that it felt like there was another story there to complete it. So yeah, I seem to be writing a third one, which again was not the plan, but then I never have a plan.
I had read the book before I started reading the reviews, which is what I like to do. And I like to read reviews just to see if I've missed anything. I already have my thoughts, so that's fine. But I was so interested in the back and forth over sort of the argument that people have of whether you needed to read The Searcher before you read The Hunter. And I don't know, because I read The Searcher, so I don't know how that works. It seems that they would stand alone, but if you can read them both, right? Do it that way.
Yeah, hey, why not? They're a lot shorter than most of my books, so it's not like you're investing the same amount of time as with some of the others, which could be murder weapons in their own right. They're that big, you know. These are shorter.
But do you think about that? I mean, do you care? Like, is that something you worry about?
I wrote The Hunter very much hoping that it would work as a standalone, right? And aiming to have it work as a standalone, because again, I think it's a very different book in that The Searcher is one guy's story, one outsider coming to a small town and defining his relationship with it. In this, I wasn't interested in one person's story. I was interested in that story that takes place between three people who are trying to create a relationship, and what happens when outside forces try to skew that, use it, undermine it. So this is a story about a pseudo family relationship in the making. And I hope it stands alone, because again, the previous one wasn't so much that. I hope it stands alone.
Oh, absolutely.
But I'm never going to be able to tell. You know, I'm the writer. There's no way.
Well, the new novel is The Hunter. It is by Tana French. It is out from Viking. Tana, it's always a delight to speak with you. Thank you so much for the beautiful work. And thank you so much for joining us this week. It's a great pleasure to have you here as always.
Joe, thank you so much for having me back. It is lovely to be here, and I will be here anytime you want me.
Tana French's new novel is The Hunter. It is published by Viking. Thanks to our producer, Sarah LeDuc. Write to us at book@wamc.org. The latest on National Productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter at wamc.org and on social media at WAMC Radio. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.